Accession number 28624, reel 11.
Small pockets of enemy who were designed, dug in, who were designed to hold up your advance. So you didn't know where they were or when you were going to meet them. You expected to find enemy on the way to the main objective. But equally, you know, if you were withdrawing and someone else was advancing towards you, you would leave pockets of enemy to hold up their advance. So it was always a you and them situation, but you really didn't know where they were or when you might meet them.
And was it like a realistic battle scene, if you like? You know, were they in trenches or something?
Oh yes, because they too had been given their part to play, and then, so they would have gone out. Perhaps they'd gone out 3 or 4 days ahead of you to do the necessary digging in, preparing camouflage, and just doing the whole thing precisely as they would in battle circumstances. Absolutely.
And so would you have come under fire?
Yes, not live fire. I mean, the exercises were run with blanks. You were firing the whole time. But there were umpires there who would be deciding whether you had sustained casualties, whether you'd inflicted casualties, but all done with blanks. Oh yes, very lifelike, yeah. And you would be taking prisoners too. I mean, once you overran a unit, if there were prisoners there to be taken, you took them.
And was it quite easy to identify, the different regiments there, or were you all kind of dressed in the same British Army uniform?
All dressed exactly the same, and the only difference might be headgear or something like that. So, yes, I mean, you would be able to identify the enemy, and no one was trying to be too clever about it, because under normal circumstances you probably would. They would be wearing a different uniform. Here no one was pretending to be anything other than the unit they were. So if the Scots Guards were acting enemy on a particular occasion, we would recognise the Scots Guards headgear or whatever. So we knew they were enemy.
Do you think it was quite, I know that you were trying to be in a battle scene, but apart from that, do you think there was like regimental honour in any of this?
Absolutely. The debriefing at the end was an essential part of the critique. The battalion commanders would be called together and left in no doubt as to how their unit had performed and whether their tactics had been up to the mark, whether the disciplines in their companies had matched those of an opposing unit. I mean, it was very seriously taken, and the critical debriefing at the end was vital, because you went off knowing what you had to improve upon, what you'd done quite well, and then the battalion commanders would pass that down to the company commanders, who would pass that down to the platoon commanders. So we were left in no doubt as to, you always know whether you perform quite well or not, but it's important to hear it from an observer too, and you then go off and improve on the shortcomings.
And you've mentioned capturing the objective. How did you know when you had captured it? Was there a guard there or something?
Yeah, I think that would be decided for you. I mean, if say the final push is a particular hill, and it invariably was, and the company was dug in, and you were moving, you advancing upon that, there would be umpires watching who would be aware as to how much firepower the defence force were chucking at the advancing force. They would be very well aware as to whether the advancing company force, perhaps us, were taking cover, or whether they were just being stupid and rushing up an open face, firing into the air. It is quite easy to know who, whether any surprise came into it, and they would determine whether we had actually achieved our aim and taken the hill or not, and you'd be told. It all sounds a bit of a Boy Scout game, and in a sense it was, but done properly, people do know whether you've achieved it or not, or part achieved it.
And were these people who decided, were they senior army personnel?
Yeah, they would be, indeed, they would be members of divisional staff or brigade staff, or if there was another unit in Kenya, and Kenya had a powerful land army there, another battalion, company commander, CO, second in command, various people would be coming along to umpire this and taking a perfectly neutral look at it all and deciding. But senior officers were all around, and they wore a white armband. They were allowed to sort of stay out of the trenches and just observe from a suitable vantage point. And a white armband on their arm meant that they were umpires. So you took no notice of them, and but they were taking a lot of notice of you.
Okay, and did you have camouflage on your face and that when you were doing that?
Oh yes, yeah. Face, arms, any part of you that wasn't clothed, had to be, day and night. Yes, you were always improving your makeup, so to speak. Touching it up because it disappears in due course, but we tended to that away.
And is it makeup or is it something like mud that you use when you're doing that?
If you take cans of camouflage cream with you. I mean, you can certainly use mud. You use whatever's right. I mean, out in Kenya, we had just cans of. It was a cream essentially. A brown cream that marked your face brown, and that was good enough, and that works day and night. In Borneo, just to cover the subject, we actually painted ourselves green there. There were no cans of cream, so we used paint, and you just brushed, dipped your paintbrush into a can of paint, green paint, and you painted your face and your arms and your hands, and off you went. So, but you can use mud too if your camouflage cream has run out or got lost. You can always adapt, and mud and water do a job.
And what about clothing? Did you have on the camouflage clothing then, or was that around?
No, it. The khaki drill, KD as it was called, was the standard form of dress, and that fades into the background quite well. I mean, again, in Borneo, in the jungle, you would be wearing jungle green, but anything that suits. But khaki drill, particularly as you got up into the northern half, close to the sort of desert area, it fades into the backdrop quite well. It wasn't. We see a lot of camouflage smocks and so on around now, and they have a part to play in various parts of the world. But KD was the thing in Kenya.
Okay. And you said before that there wasn't a threat when you were out there, that you were training for Kuwait.
We were in standby for Kuwait. Lest anyone. Cast a covetous eye on Kuwait's oil wealth, as of course subsequently happened about 1990 or 92, whenever it was, when Saddam moved in. But that was our standby. That was our reason for being there. But We were never called, nothing ever happened. And then the sort of fly-out occasions were the two we've discussed, Zanzibar one, Swaziland another.
And was there any specific training that you got for Kuwait, you know, like how to deal with oil wells or anything like that?
Not oil wells, no, but the form of training we're undertaking, you know, Kenya is a perfect training area for something like Kuwait. The levels of heat are similar. The difficulties in resupplying, particularly water, are pretty similar. And the terrain is, once you, I mean, assuming Kuwait is all desert, there's a lot of desert or very barren rock and sandy earth to be found in the northern part of Kenya, the northern frontier district, and we trained a lot up there. But training on the plains of Kenya are perfectly adequate training ground for Kuwait.
You mentioned Swaziland there. Did you go there with the regiment?
Yes, I certainly did. Yeah, we flew out. I honestly forget when it was, but I think it was about the middle of the year, 1963, and that was a sudden take on.
And had you been aware of the situation, you know, before that?
Absolutely not. No. It was as sudden as could be. I mean, we were all doing our perfectly normal training, such as I've described, standing by for Kuwait. And the particular day when we suddenly received, the battalion headquarters, we received the order that we were to fly out that night, we had a bit of a job gathering everyone, because fortunately no one was out any distance, I don't think, on company training or platoon training. I know I was away. I was out on a forward air controlling day, not very far, 30, 40 miles away, I think, from camp, but I was out with just myself and my driver and a radio set, and we were controlling aircraft, and someone came along to tell us that we had to get straight back to camp. And we didn't even know where we were going. I mean, they, on the basis that you only are told what you need to be told, we were simply told we were flying out. Everyone was told exactly what to take. So the company paraded with kit bags at about 5 o'clock in the evening, I think. And then we trucks appeared, and we were taken Royal Corps Transport. There was a unit in Gilgil appeared with all their trucks. We bundled the platoon and time into a truck at a time and flew down to Nairobi Airport to be flown out. And we still didn't know where we were going. And we boarded the Beverly aircraft. The Royal Air Force had provided the old wartime transport and command. Transport they were, or bombers, and we boarded these very old flying machines. And at one stage, I remember the word had leaked out that we were flying out to Switzerland. It didn't seem to matter. We weren't aware that the Swiss were our enemy, but if they were, then we would deal with them properly. In point of fact, it was very close, but it was Swaziland, not Switzerland. So that didn't matter. Once we were told we were going to Swaziland, we would deal with them too. Didn't matter whether they were Swiss or Swazis. And so we flew out that night, and the aircraft, of course, had to refuel. I mean, Swaziland is down in South Africa, a long flight from Kenya, and we had to refuel at Salisbury Airport, Northern Rhodesia, as it was then, and because it was a rather sensitive thing to be flying from one African country to another African country on an operational basis, it needed a friendly place such as Northern Rhodesia to allow us to refuel. But whilst they were refueling, we were all, this was done at the far end of Salisbury Airport. We were meant to be out of sight and had to get into hangars whilst all this was happening and then continue our journey and land in Swaziland. So that happened overnight and sometime in mid-June, I think, in 1963.
Okay. And so did it mean that you left some kit behind at Gildon?
Yeah, yes, we did. We, you know, you just take what you have to take and take what you're ordered to take and lock up your rooms or your billets and leave behind everything else. Yes, because we were always going to be going back to that camp. That camp was still our camp, but you just lock the place up. And you always leave a small rear party too, who then continue the guard of the camp and ensure that everything is locked up, no break-ins, no windows broken, no theft or looting going on. And the place is secure enough, and sure enough, when we came back, I forget how long, 8 or 10 weeks later, about 3 months, was it? I don't know. We just came back and carried on as normal.
And did you take your rifles and ammunition in it?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. All the weapons, company weapons are taken out, and you know, each man, depending on whatever he or he was, rifleman, machine gunner, rocket launchers taken, mortars taken, the whole lot.
And did you travel in your uniform?
Yeah, yeah, we did. Yeah, this was an operational emergency, so, I mean, you actually landed, you know, ready for action. And when we got to the end of the runway, I was taking my platoon out as point platoon to secure, you know, the, we didn't know what was going to be there. And, you know, because we really had no orders, we just knew this was an emergency. So you're operational from the moment you get there, and you get your platoon rushing out down, you know, already deployed, and then you to deploy it on the runway to secure that. What we weren't quite ready for were the women's voluntary service ladies who had their tea trolleys there to welcome us. That stopped us short in our tracks, really. But it was operational otherwise.
You didn't knock any of them down?
No, right? Certainly not. Certainly not.
Okay. So when you did arrive at the airport, did it feel like there was a sense of emergency, or with seeing these ladies, did that calm the situation?
Oh yeah, no, it didn't seem like that at all, and it wasn't, and it transpired that the unrest was sort of communist inspired. They were trying to generate mistrust and creating grievances that might have genuinely been there, or creating them anyway, just to generally unsettle the workforce in Swaziland, whether they were in the asbestos mines up in the hills or down in the sugarcane plantations. And so it was a political sort of operation, you know, but there was, if there was unrest, it wasn't apparent. And we having arrived there and finding that there was no airport to secure, because the airport was quite secure and everything was calm, we were then allocated various parts to go to my company, company in which I served, B Company. It went to, stayed at Emberbaan, which was the capital. D Company went to Manzini, not all that far away. That's the second town of Swaziland. It's a small country. And A Company went up into the hills. They were up in the asbestos area, something pink, I forget, but they went up there. Battalion headquarters stayed in Emberbaan, the capital as well. And so we were just deployed ourselves, settled in, and took up the accommodation which had been allocated. We were allocated a school in Emberbahn, B Company, and there we stayed. And it was immediately after that then that we started the operations to uncover the troublemakers, and these were done by cordon and searches of villages, roadblocks up and down the country, and that's the sort of operation we did. But you know, the unrest, as I say, was not about at all.
So do you remember when you landed at the airport, was it quite a disappointment when you got off this plane, you know?
No, not a disappointment. You know, I have to say you're quite keyed up when you go, and it's all very exciting and so on. But no, it's not a letdown, or it's not disappointing. You just look around, have a look at the place, see what's necessary, do what you think you have to do, and await further orders. But securing the airport was not difficult because there was no one to secure it from or against. But no, I don't think disappointed. Just get on with the next thing.
And was this airport, was it at the capital?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, a few miles from Emberbahn.
And Swaziland, is it a wealthy country? Or?
No, not really. It, even though there was sufficient work, I would say, from memory, for the workforce. Sugarcane was their only export, I would think. But there was farming, pretty good farming, good climate to feed the country itself. And asbestos, of course, was another mining thing, and export. It was prosperous enough.
Okay. And when you first arrived there, what were your initial impressions of it?
Very different to Kenya, and but you know, an attractive country nevertheless. We left the wildlife behind, which was sad, but you know, I think impressions were not great. I'm just always interested to come to a new country, but I can't remember any sort of lasting impression at all.
Did it remind you of where you came from, you know, from Kenya or from Zanzibar? Was it anything like those two countries?
Well, yes, I suppose it was. I mean, insofar as it was agricultural, you know, it bore resemblance to Kenya. But I think no other impressions particularly.
And the school where you were accommodated, was it a brick building, stone building, or?
It was perfectly nicely built and modern school. And the school continued to run. We just took the hall, or the gymnasium, whatever it might have been. And that is where, you know, we met and gathered, and of course we assembled and paraded for checks and so on, musters and so on, in the playground. And in the other half of the playground, the kids would be playing. And their classrooms were left entirely to them and for them, and we had no access to that. But we were within the school boundaries, and our accommodation was their hall where our company lived.
And do you think you had a sense of curiosity to the children?
Oh yeah, enormous curiosity. Yes, oh yes. They were, you know, they were watching our every move, and I say we shared a playground, but they were encroaching on our half a great deal more than we did on theirs. Oh yes, they couldn't keep away from us.
And was it just the platoon that was in the school?
No, we were a company. That was B Company. So we were three platoons in company headquarters, being a 110-120 men, so they had the whole camp there around there.
So was it quite cramped in this hall?
Yeah, it was, yeah. You'll get used to that. Yes, it was, yeah.
And were you sleeping in beds or sleeping on the floor?
I think we were supplied with camp beds. They would, whether we flew out with them or whether they came in the next sort of flight a day or two later, I don't know. But camp beds were certainly obtained quickly enough.
And was it quite noisy in there? You know, if there had been, like, if men were going out at different times and, you know, was it quite noisy to try and get to sleep in there?
Oh, I have to say that I didn't sleep there. The officers officers were billeted very close by, and there was an apartment block, and we had two rooms. Well, we had an apartment, which I think was two bedrooms, so we were doubling up there. Yes, but insofar as one platoon might be out and two in, and then the platoon comes back, it's always noisy and unsettling and step on, but that's all part of soldiering, yeah.
But the apartment you were in, was it quite comfortable?
Certainly comfortable. There were four beds, which was one each, and the table and a chair, something like that. Yeah, it was, and a bathroom, of course, which was excellent. So, yeah, it was comfortable, but hardly ritzy.
Did that not give you problems with security, you know, with you being away from the men?
I'm not aware. I suppose it could have. Yes, I suppose so, yes. You know, you certainly a walk away from the camp, so to speak, if we can call the school camp, which it was. We were a walk away, but there was certainly no feeling of insecurity. Yeah.
And did you have a guard on the apartment? Or
no, not at all, no. We were our own guards.
So, when you were in the capital, was there a threat there? Did you feel that there was a threat in the capital?
Not at all. No, and nor did the people of Mbaban feel there was a threat at all. I don't think they'd ever felt insecure. And we met lots of them and talked to them all the time, because after the first 2 or 3 weeks, when most of the work was done, but though we did continue, we were always patrolling and resuming a keeping the peace stance. We met many people socially and just in the course of day-to-day work, and they'd never felt insecure at all. There were just political undertones creeping into the area, as indeed had happened in Zanzibar. But not a lack of security, and there was no violence for them to be frightened of.
And the population there, was it a mixed population, or was it just mainly local people?
Mixed, white and coloured. I mean, you know, a lot of South Africans, a lot of British over there running the plantations or the mines or working professionally, you know, doctoring or whatever. And then, local population, the Swazis, were both in this small town and out in the countryside.
Okay. And I remember when you were speaking about Zanzibar, you were speaking about going out with the local police.
Yeah.
When you went out and patrol here, where did you have local police?
Yes, yeah, we most certainly did. And these, again, might be, they were largely officered by South Africans, the Swazi police force. And, of course, there were Swazis who were in the police force, perhaps constables. Well, perhaps they were officers too. I certainly was out with both. I mean, if you were doing a cordon and search,